Welcome to the Intentional Communities panel. It's my honor to be able to facilitate this today. My name is Chris Pendleton. I'm the coordinator of Developing Ecological Agriculture Practices. We're a student group here on campus. Today we're bringing you a very diverse panel in the Intentional Communities world. We have speakers who represent the academic field, the academic side of eco-village studies and design. We have those who a speaker who represents the community aspect, a speaker who represents the activist, or excuse me, the legal aspect, and a speaker who represents the political aspect of intentional communities. So I'd like to introduce these speakers. Actually, before I do that, I'll write these terms down, but I'd like to define an eco-village as defined by In Context. Either of you have a year on that? 1990. Magazine In Context defined eco-villages as this in 1990. A human-scale, full-featured settlement in which human activities are harmlessly integrated into the material world in a way that is supportive of healthy human development and can be continued into the indefinite future. And that's a 5-point definition that I'll write over there on that white piece of paper. And so without further ado, the speakers that will be speaking about intentional communities, E. Christopher Mayer over here. E. Christopher Mayer has finished the world's first graduate program in eco-village design from Antioch University. He is founder of the Village Design Institute, which teaches courses every year in eco-village design. He has taught eco-village design at Fairhaven College and at Western Washington University, and is also a permaculture teacher. Welcome, E. Christopher Mayer. So he represents our academic side. For our community side, we have Diana Leaf Christian. Diana Leaf Christian is editor of Communities Magazine. She, for the last 10 years, she's been doing that, and she actually got her start here at Evergreen in the Communities, what was it called?
Celebration of Community Conference.
Oh, we need a mic on this one. Got it. Cool. Thanks.
Okay. The Celebration of Communities Conference in 1993.
And that happened here at Evergreen. She was camping out in the parking lot with the rest of them. Yeah. And she got the job here for editing Communities Magazine. She's also written a book, Creating a Life Together, on how to create an eco-village successfully. And she is living now at Earth Haven Eco-Village in North Carolina. So welcome, Diana Leaf Christian. For our legal side, we have Ben Kaufman. Ben takes eco-village design concepts to the mainstream development through his through his company, Greenworks Realty in Seattle. He takes these eco-village design developments, ideas to mainstream development by building green homes and through community projects. So, Ben Kaufman, welcome. And finally, our political activist, Brandi McPherson. She's a co-founder of Our Eco-Village, O-U-R Eco-Village in B.C. With this community, she has worked with 11 different government officials, official offices, correct, to create a community that meets code in B.C. and through this has set a precedent in land use management in Canada. Welcome, Brandi. So we're going to do 20-minute presentations, and then we'll open up the panel to Q&A with y'all. So,
do you have a watch?
I do have a watch.
Tell me when it's 20.
Okay, I'll cut you off.
Well, my name is Diana Christian, and I live at Earth Haven Eco Village in the mountains of western North Carolina. I've just been there a month and a half, although I've been a member 3 years. I hope that tells you something. Sometimes it takes a while to build a homestead and move your way into a lifestyle that's completely different from mainstream culture. I've been editing Communities Magazine for the last 10 years. And in that time, because literally hundreds of articles have passed across my desk, and people who have formed communities and lived in communities have been telling their story. I've learned a great deal about what they have experienced and what tends to work well and what tends not to work well in forming communities and aspiring to living in an eco-village. And also from traveling around the country and giving workshops, meeting people in communities and meeting founders of communities, I've been sort of gleaning what tends to work well and what not. And to my great dismay, I was studying communities that got started in the 90s or were hoping to start themselves in the 1990s. And it seemed to me that about 10% actually succeeded and got land and remained viable and functioning and having meetings and living on their land together and doing their common purpose together. Only about 10%. And about 90% seemed to fail or disband. Now, some of them would disband in reasons like, well, we're all young parents and we really don't have the time to meet in committee meetings and group meetings once a week. Sometimes they would disband because they'd been going 4 years looking for land and they never had because Mr. or Ms. Fat Cat cigar developer with a cigar would come along and buy the land right out from under them right when they were about to get their ideal piece of land because the developer had access to capital and clout and political connections and they didn't. But most of the time they would disband in conflict. Severe conflict and often heartbreak and often conflict, heartbreak, and lawsuits. So here they were, starting out the best of friends, or maybe not the best of friends, but at least people with the best of intentions, looking to connect with each other, to cooperate, to create harmony and connection, to share resources and to do something wonderful. And here they were, in a court of law, duking it out with their hired gladiator lawyers. It broke my heart. I wanted to know what the 10% were doing. I wanted to know what the 90% were doing. Were the 90% doing something different than the 10%? And were they doing different but opposite things? And they were. I looked into it. I started asking questions and just really looking into it. And they absolutely were different, doing different things. And I thought, oh my God, somebody ought to write this down, you know? Well, you know how that goes. So I did. And so the book that I wrote was an attempt to glean from founders of successful communities what had they done and what had they learned and what had they recommended that not be done and what would they never do again, you know? And I wanted to learn cautionary tales from those brave, heroic folks who were going, rats, it didn't work. And so I put together lots and lots of stories, and then I went and taught myself a modicum of information about legal structures and financing and real estate and escrow and budgets and strategic plans and that kind of thing, enough to try to convey that to people in the book. And so that's how come I go around talking about this. It's from standing on the shoulders of those giants who, in my mind, are heroes who have founded communities, and those well-meaning folks who, in my mind, are heroes who have attempted to found communities. And some of you out there may be among these groups. Some of you may be intending to go be in communities or eco-villages, and some of you may have already tried and maybe have a little bit of heartbreak about it, and some of you may be living in communities and or aspiring eco-villages. So that's a little bit about how I've come to be here. The definition which Chris just described is my favorite definition of eco-villages, which I'd like to go over again. Human-scale, full-featured settlement in which human activities are fully integrated into the natural landscape in a way that is supportive of healthy human development and which can be successfully continued into the indefinite future. Long run-on sentence. Human-scale, we all know each other. We can make decisions together. We make decisions that affect the outcome of what we're doing together. My life is affected by decisions that I have a strong voice in. And I know all of us by sight, and I know our names. Human scale. Full-featured settlement. Well, settlement, we live here, and we work here. We don't have to work here, but we can choose to. We don't have to go work for the man off-site. We work for each other, maybe, on-site. We can socialize here. We can choose to go somewhere else and go to that contra dance or that movie or that play. But we can also have all kinds of homegrown socializing and entertainment right here in our aspiring eco-village. And our spiritual needs are met here. We can do our spiritual practice without anybody laughing at us. And we have other people to do it with, whatever it is. Eclectically, we all do different things. Some of us do, some of us don't. Or whatever our spiritual flavor is. We can go off-site to do it, but we don't have to. So we're getting our social, spiritual, living, and working needs met here, which would imply that we probably have our own food that we grow. Probably we grow it sustainably. Probably we have non-toxic natural buildings. If we're lucky, we might be using off-grid power. Maybe if zoning permits, we have constructed wetlands and water catchment or one or another of the many ecological and sustainable options for living, or at least we, as an aspiring eco-village, are hoping to do that. Okay, human activities harmlessly integrated into the natural landscape means that whatever we're doing for living, working, socializing, our spiritual life, etc., we're not messing with the microorganisms in the soil or borrowing from our children and our grandchildren in terms of air quality, water quality, soil health and fertility, the plants and animals around us, the creepers, the crawlers, the flyers, and so on. And we're doing it in a way that is healthy of our own development. Now, here's where I have to give you a caveat emptor, because I don't know any aspiring eco-village where everybody isn't working their butt off. So they're not exactly having healthy human development yet, I'd say, because everybody's usually just exhausted. Because this is hard. It's hard to go against the grain of North American culture and say, hey, we're doing a political activism act that's different than American culture by how we live. And by the way, come over and visit and see what we're doing. Whew, it's hard. Well, you bring your work gloves, you know. So I think that we're not there yet in a lot of aspiring eco-villages to be, you know, having healthy human development, I think it's really pretty hard for a lot of folks. Perhaps that's in the near future. The last part, and can be successfully continued into the indefinite future. Well, doesn't it sound like our friends, the Six Nation Iroquois, saying that any decision we make has to be good for the next seven generations? So that's a little bit about how I see that definition that Robert and Diane Gilman came up with in Denmark in 1990 with Ross Jackson and Hilder Jackson, and together they got the idea to start the Global Eco-Village Network. And if you're interested in eco-village activism or learning more about eco-villages, we'll be telling you more about how you can find out on the website, but there's one that's Global Eco-Village Network, GEN. That's all? Isn't it at Gaia.org?
I think you can get it.org.
Okay. GEN.org, says Brandy. And then there's ina.gaia.org, which is Ecovillage Network of the Americas. That's South and North America. And by the way, it is not Northern Hemispherocentric. It's Southern Hemispherocentric on purpose. And there are regional Eco-Village Networks, Northwest Intentionals Community Association, ic.org/NICA, can help folks find intentional communities and eco-villages here in the Northwest. So what did I find out when I was looking at what helped people get communities and eco-villages going and what seemed to be a problem? So I'd like to just briefly go over some of the six essential things that seem to work well. I came up with this idea that there was something called structural conflict. And this is not some technical and scientific term. I just up and made it up. Structural conflict, in my mind, is when a community or an aspiring eco-village group does not put certain key structures in place at the very beginning of them attempting to do what they're doing. And because they don't have them there, a few weeks later, a few years later, a few months later, the fact that they don't have it just really comes and bites them. And there's horrific, terrible conflict in the group. And people think it's because Reginald is being a jerk or Hildegard is being unreasonable, but really it's structural. So here's what I think they are. And by the way, somebody else who's looking at this would probably slice this pie in a different way. So please know this is just my idiosyncratic way of looking at it. First of all, have a common vision and purpose. Know what it is. Know that you have it. If you have a vision statement, have everybody know what it is. Know why you're there. Know If you're all in a car together going somewhere, know where you're going together. Can you imagine the conflict you won't have if you're all going to the same place? And you know you are. This is the most important thing. This is when I go and do consultations for groups. I say, this is the first thing you need to have. Okay. Secondly, a fair and participatory decision-making process so that we each can fairly have a voice into our common future together. If somebody's deciding things for us, which I haven't seen in 10 years of people trying to be intentional communities, but if somebody else is, it wouldn't be fair and people would feel terribly resentful. Part two of this one here is, and if it's consensus decision-making, and this is really heavy for me, so let me say it again. If it's consensus decision-making, please make sure that we've got all the criteria for it instead of using something that's not right for us. In my opinion, consensus is like a chainsaw. It can chop a lot of wood, but it can chop your leg. So let's make sure we've got the criteria for it, which is, first of all, we have a common vision and purpose. And secondly, we all have equal access to power. One of us is not the landlord and the rest tenants. One is not the boss and the rest employees. We have equal access to power. And thirdly, we have been trained in it. We've been well trained in it. There's wonderful trainers of consensus right here in the Pacific Northwest. Carolyn Estes at Alpha Farm, Tree Bresson at Walnut Street Co-op in Eugene, Rob Sandelin at Sharing Wood Co-Housing in Snohomish. These folks are wonderful consensus trainers. So if you're going to be doing consensus, I highly recommend any of them. Okay, the third thing is have clear agreements and in writing. And also have clear agreements in writing. And thirdly, have clear agreements that are written down. And this is not because I think anybody wants to cheat anybody. And please don't let anybody say, oh, don't you trust me? Hey, we're trying to do community here. We're not trying to do mainstream culture where you write things down. We're doing community. Oh, no, please, I beg of you, on my knees, write it down. It's because human nature, being that it is, we don't remember things the same way other people remember them. Not for any reasons of cheating, but because that's the way human memory is. I'll remember the middle of the conversation. You'll remember the end of the conversation. Wasn't it 3 weeks and $400? No, it was 4 weeks and $500. No, no, it was 6 weeks and $700. We just go look up what we wrote down. Easy, problem solved. Everybody, write down your policies, your agreements, your decisions. Have a decision log. New people come to your group, have them look at the decision log so they'll know what has already been decided. Okay, clear agreements in writing. The fourth one is know what you need to know. In embarking on this incredible journey known as creating community or creating an eco-village, you need to know the stuff that you need to know in order to go on this journey. So I have it, simplistically, divided into right brain and left brain kinds of things. Right brain things, communicating from the heart, speaking truthfully, knowing how to connect with each other in ways that if we have conflict, which is when we don't agree about something and one or more of us has a charge on it, that we can stay feeling connected even though we are disagreeing, even though we're agreeing to disagree and we're thinking, well, you think this and I think this. Let's see how we can work this out. Good communication and process skills. I suggest learning them now in the beginning of meeting in each other's living rooms before we ever have any land, just the way children learn a fire drill when there's no fire. Let's get good at this now. There's all kinds of workshops, books, workshop presenters, and so on, and all kinds of good communication skills. It's really important. I consider good decision-making and good consensus decision-making a partly right brain, partly left brain skill. So I'm going to put it in this pile of right brain skills. Having a common vision, knowing how to vision together, knowing how to share from the hearts what it is we want to do in this community. Left brain skills, budget, strategic plan, cash flow projection. Do we know how real estate works? What's escrow? What's financing? We got to know this stuff. What? We got to know this? I didn't come here to be working for the man. I didn't come here to know about mainstream culture stuff like finance, budget, strategic plans, computer spreadsheets, calculators. We need to use tools of the mainstream culture to create alternatives to mainstream culture. And then we can say, bye. But I don't know that there's somebody who's going to give us land. We've got to go buy it. I don't know that somebody's going to go, here's $400,000 and $500 more to come for your development processes in order for y'all to do what it is that you want to do, because I just, from the goodness of my heart, trust all you folks. I don't think so. I think what we have to do is take a leaf from the book of well-managed small nonprofits and well-managed small ecologically oriented businesses and be businesslike. Do it like they do. That's what the 10% have done and the 90%, oh no, they didn't. Okay. So another thing to need to know on the technical side would be what are the legal structures that we need to have for owning property together or perhaps operating our service project together? And that's the kind of know what you need to know that I suggest. Okay, the last two to wrap up here. One would be have good communication and process skills. Now, see, I'm being redundant and on purpose. And the last one is the controversial one. And if you have brought in rotten tomatoes, get them out now, because this is the one where people go, wait a minute. And that is choose people to join you based on them being able to get along well with human beings. Choose people to join you based on what I call choose for emotional maturity. Well, how do you know? I'll get to that in a sec. But first of all, you want them to be aligned and resonant with your community vision and purpose. No sense having Reginald and Hildegard join you if they want to do something completely different or if they want to tell you, well, we want to do what you do. But really, we want to change your minds once we get in the community. No, don't say yes to them, please. The other thing you want is that they get along well with folks, that they can meet the financial requirements and they can meet the labor requirements. I always recommend asking for references, and you say, oh, yes, but they'll only give you people that like them. And, well, that's true, but then you can find out what those people say. Also, if you ask somebody for references and they say, oh, okay, here. Or if you ask them for references and they say, oh, well, that'll tell you something, right? You would like to know how they got along with their college roommates, their other roommates, people they've lived with, people they've gone on long trips with, people they've worked with, people they've been in worker-owned co-ops with. This is really crucial. Somebody who has extreme difficulties getting along with folks can take a group down. And I have seen it over and over, especially small groups and new groups. So if later in the question and answer section, y'all want to say, I don't agree with that, please go right ahead, because people always do say that. And I guess that's about it on what I want to say in my little portion of this panel. Thank you so much for being interested in the subject of eco-villages and intentional communities.
Thanks, Diana. I want to invite anybody there up on the stairs, if you all want to move down, there's some seats available that allow people to move up to the tabling area a little bit easier. Also, please beware that the characters used in Diana's examples are fictional. If you know any Reginald and Hildegard, chances are it probably is not them that you're using the example of, correct? Okay, next, Brandy McPherson.
Am I on? Not quite. Is that on? Is it on? Okay, thanks. So I'm just having huge flashbacks as I'm sitting here, and it kind of came to mind when you mentioned, Diana, the 1993 Intentional Communities Conference that was held here at Evergreen. And I was here as well. And it was the first time I ever heard the term eco-village, I realize, as I'm back in the space. And my background is coming from born and raised on a commune, as we called ourselves in those days, and sort of walking with the evolution of what community meant in many ways. And I came from a really diverse kind of commune, communal structure, and also was raised part-time on a reserve, as we say in Canada. And so I come from a First Nations community and a commune, and it's a pretty amazing way to learn about community building for me. And I really didn't get that until many decades later as my life evolved and actually became a bureaucrat for a while, which was a real fun pendulum swing. And then came back into what I understood was the communities movement and showed up here with 1,200 people from all over the world and inner city co-housing in New York to kibbutzes in Israel and realized, oh my God, there's people all over the world that are doing this in so many different ways. And so when I first saw the term eco-village and saw that definition, I realized, well, that's what we've all been talking about for a really long time. And so somebody's now put a new definition and new measure and ways to do that. And I went back to my home community in Canada, Vancouver Island, and said, okay, so, you know, there's at least 100 of us having this conversation, and how do we all get into one room? And thus community building is born. Wherever it is in the world, it's pretty much just the dialogue starts, as far as I know. And our process came through quite a evolutionary period, but really what I want to talk about is the big focus that we accidentally had on doing the political work. So, you know, a group of small-minded folks, a small group of like-minded people come together. Some people thought we were small-minded for sure, and dared to dream. And out of that, we stepped forward. Eventually, you know, circle after circle of people coming and going, we stepped forward and said, you know what, let's just buy the land, build the field, and we'll know who the players are. And so in many ways, compared to what Diana is saying, is get the structure all down pat, get your agreements, know your policies. Well, we didn't even know who we were in order to create that together. So we went out and said, well, a couple of us will go and buy the land, and then we'll see what happens. And perhaps unwittingly, but definitely magically, we realized as soon as we got there that we had to do that foundational work. We had to take on the political and legal work behind creating the whole process of the community building and actually developing an eco-village. And so we went to our local planners and said, before we really do this in this community, we'd like to know if we're welcome here. We'd like to say what we have to bring and see if there's any way we can serve in this community. Probably politically astute action number one, not coming in and being the wise folks that have the answers and coming into a community and asking whether we might be able to share in a process and whether that could serve in any way. And from there, our relationship that developed, when Chris was talking about 11 levels, that's 11 levels of government and regulatory authorities within Canada, slowly came to the table one by one and said, well, you have to deal with us if you're going to do this. And, you know, if we'd have known that in the beginning, it probably scared us right off. But we didn't know it, and we were just told, well, you're going to have to rezone that property if you think you're going to do all these activities. And so we offer ourselves up as an example, because that's what we step forward to do. And the first year that we were on the land, we stopped and said, let's do a really kind of non-North American white guy kind of thing and not do anything. And actually sit on the land and just be here and just listen to the land and ask the land what wants to happen here and find out from a permaculture perspective where the prevailing winds are and what happens here in different seasons. And, you know, people couldn't believe that we weren't just getting on with things. And that's not very, you know, big activist kind of thing to do. But it was a profound thing to do. And again, it is part of setting the foundation and the space and getting into relationship. Because in many respects, whether you're talking about permaculture work or eco-village design, ultimately it really is all about relationship with each other, with the land, with ourselves, with the creator, whichever way you want to cut it. So that important year, again, laying the foundation. And what we did as a next step from there is step forward. Here was our way of creating policy and vision and mission statement. But as an example, step forward in a political move to bring in every bit of the wider community who would come to visioning processes and asked everybody and anybody and their children and their aunts and uncles if they wanted to come out and from every level of government, and they did. And that served as the basis for theming and creating a profile to do a sustainable land management model that's now set a precedent in Canada. So it's a little bit about the actual example, and I'm going to point to it if I can step away here, just to show you an idea of how that can happen. I'm just going to stand up, but can I pull this off? Can you hear me still? Is that on there? Is it on now? How's that there? Oh, there we go. Okay. So what we did, now try and imagine in some strange way bringing together group process, sort of a human and social idea about sustainability, an economic idea about sustainability, and an environmental ideal about sustainability, because that's where all the perspectives of the people that we were dealing with came from. So pretty holistic. And then you sit them all down and you get all kinds of ideas from them, and you really get what you ask for. You get diversity. And then you got to think about what to do with that. So again, political sort of process number two was to really garner all that wisdom and information from the wider community. And in that ideal, we're not just talking about local wider community, we're talking about international wider community, and sending out expressions of interest to people around the world and asking them if they want to be part of a design process. When we went through the theming process, what happened is we came down to four specific activities to focus on. And you'll see this a lot in Ecovillage Designs. And what they are is conservation work, agricultural focus, residential focus, and educational focus. And you know, you can realize pretty quickly that within an educational focus, you can fit almost anything in the world under that. But that can become a format for doing permaculture design work. It's also an ability to walk forward with regulatory authorities and give them something quite specific to deal with. So these are the activities that we want to have happen. And within that, you can delineate so many other kind of groups of things, that how that's going to look. So and again, in this local example, what we did is we took a third of the property and made it into park, overlaying two land trusts on the title and actually gave them title to, you can see this in the dark green area, it's a woodland wetland conservation zone, fully mapped by teams of biologists, mega partnerships in order to create this aspect of the design. But people are out there in the community, they're doing amazing work, the resources offered up to them, they come in with their skills base and contribute to the overall design process. Everybody owns the community, in a sense. It's great because it fits in with the philosophy of OUR Ecovillage. Our Ecovillage, as soon as you use the name, you kind of become part of the process. And it really speaks to the philosophy of it not just being our community or our world or our kids, but it's a way of engaging and owning our responsibility in this world and the way we create community together. So going back around to the themes, looking at the agricultural sector, in doing design work like this, you again have the ability to bring in all kinds of local food systems, food security, educators. Everybody and anybody that's operating within the realm of that, within the wider community, has a space to use. Residential sector. Something really interesting happened with this example. This was being turned into a subdivision at the time of purchase, and the subdivision was stopped in order to create this model. Which was a really good leverage point, because in a community, when you can show a sustainable land management design and people get kind of worried and say, what are you doing? And that's something really unknown, and the unknown's kind of scary. And then you can refer them back to what the general option is, which is a subdivision, and you can show the difference between the two, then you've got some leverage to do some community building and to do some political work. So, for example, 25 acres with a local community plan, you could have five parcels. Every parcel has two houses. So now you have 10 driveways, 10 sets of septic fields, 10 sets of power poles, 10, 10, 10, all the way down the line. Or you could take the same density averaging and cluster those houses into one small space, limit the square footage, get really responsible about our ecological footprint, have one shared wastewater treatment system, and in fact call out to have a biological wastewater treatment system that can be a demonstration and an education for other people, so you can jump through the bylaw hoops with the public health inspectors and actually bring them on side. And then every bit of infrastructure that supports your residential work becomes an education apparatus, and it becomes a political maneuver within your community because you're demonstrating it far and wide. So, and the housing itself, in our case, we have an on-site natural building school, and so people are being educated in natural building, but it's also a political ally to say, we have the right to healthy and affordable housing. We have the right to be able to build houses that are non-toxic and to not be, I heard Mark Linkman say today that mortgage means death grip or something. So to not sell our souls to have a house, but to actually be able to afford to build out of earthen homes, to demonstrate that and to have open tours where people can walk through and just start rippling that out far and wide. And they take their own political agenda out to where they want to go. And then lastly, in a model like this, having an education allowance within rezoning means that, you know, there's a lot of communities out there that do education work. It doesn't mean that we were allowed to do it all those years. It means that we looked over our shoulder with the potential being shut down at any time or busted for public gathering or you know, education work that wasn't allowed on site, being busted for and shut down for housing that didn't have building inspectors. And this model was all about coming out of the closet and politically saying, you know what, this is activities that really do speak a full-featured human settlement. There's other places in the world. This isn't new. The whole design of eco-village development has existed since, you know, time forgotten, and we have forgotten maybe in some ways. But in Europe and in so many places, in older settlements, you can see this example over and over. So being able to talk to regulatory authorities on that level and say, you know what, we'll just look at what else is out there until we get to understanding how to create it here. And we were joking earlier when we talked before this session that we came up with a bit of a cliche in our group, and sitting at the table with 11 levels of regulatory reform, we declared that no was just an uneducated yes. And so every time we heard no at that table, we had to be prepared to sit at the table until we educated ourselves, maybe not literally sit, but keep coming back to the table until we educated ourselves enough in possibility and created more options till we could actually get to yes. And, you know, and thus dreams are born into realities. And somehow, some way, one after another, we had examples of the head of the ministry of, who hand-delivered approval processes to our door, pulled them out of six-month wait list piles, and then would come to our door and then go stand by our little Cobb playhouse in the children's garden with tears in his eyes and say, you know, this is what we dreamt about in the 60s. And the same guy who takes off his hat and shows us a picture of the Dalai Lama inside his hat. He wasn't the big, you know, big, scary regulatory authority that everybody thought he was. This is a man who, within the context of that local community, somebody's thrown a running chainsaw at because they were so angry at him. But here was a human being who said, I actually believe in something. I had a dream. I started out in my profession because I had a dream. And really, about being in relationship was about tapping back into that dream with him and that place of possibility. And why did he start out doing this 30 years ago? And as soon as that can get teased out, suddenly you have alliances and more alliances and more alliances, and community building just gets bigger and bigger and more powerful as you go. So over and over within Canada, this model gets looked at, and people say, how in God's name did you get through that? And it really only was through relationship building. Every community event we could be at, every community event we could create, and this is from the heart. This isn't like just because it's a political maneuver. But because it's important, because community is what you make it, and there's no other way for community to happen other than by making it happen, we'd be out there. We'd be having open houses. We'd be in politicians' offices. They'd be at our dinner table. And all the boundaries get blurred. So those divisions in the way that the world works suddenly took on a different context. And we all become quite equal people together that just share a dream about having a really wonderful place to live in a world where we're not threatened by things and where we can actually empower ourselves to step back into the formalization of our social structure. And come to the understanding that on a political level, a lot of people want help. They want the community to stand up and say what they believe in and what they want. It might be kind of scary to listen to what's said. Might be way scarier to imagine enacting it. But, you know, Mark Lakeman's example today of what can happen in a city like Portland, and a Canadian example of what can happen in a rural community where people just keep strengthening and strengthening and the circle goes out wider. There's a lot of ways to define intentional community. There's a lot of ways to define an eco-village, but at the base of it, if you're starting with relationship, whether you want to call that political or community or legal or all the ways we've sort of highlighted it today, it's still going to always come back to that first step about relationship. So this is really just offered up as an example. The work that is done internationally and just by the by, the Global Eco-Village Network is actually having the annual conference in British Columbia this year in September. So it's an opportunity that's quite close by. There'll be some eco-village design workshops with some of the international names that people know in design work, and then there's a lot of us locally that do design work as well. So there's going to be a real kind of 100th monkey thing happening, I think, on the Pacific Northwest, and as people just kind of come together with that collective consciousness, and we'll see what ripples out after that. Thank you.
Hello, hello. Hello.
I just wanted to say something quickly before Chris speaks, and that is some context that you might not realize is that it's extremely difficult for forming communities and forming eco-villages to deal with zoning, which is one of the biggest stoppers for them actually getting going, which is why what Brandy and the folks at Our Eco Village did is so magnificent and unprecedented and beneficial news for all of us.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. It takes quite a lot of commitment to get one of these on the ground. Being the academic speaker here, I have the liberty to stay in the visionary world, the world of theory and concepts, but down there on the ground, that's where it's really happening, and I just have the most respect for Candy. It's really wonderful to be here at Evergreen. It's the cultural capital of Ecotopia. I'd like to make some qualifying remarks. All eco-villages are intentional communities, but not all intentional communities are eco-villages, if that makes sense. Intentional communities, a group of students sharing a house together is an intentional community, but that's by no means an eco-village. And as you look around, the word eco-village gets used an awful lot. It has quite a lot of an appeal to it. In my first village design course, I asked Max Lindiger, what is it about an eco-village that makes it a village? And he had to think for a while. He said, well, he's from Switzerland. So he said, a village is large enough to contain a church, and hamlets don't have churches, which is a kind of a cute answer, but it brings to light from a human geography perspective or settlement geography perspectives, there's many different scales of settlements, and what is it about the village that's so appealing? North America seemed to skip the village. Well, post-colonization North America seemed to skip the village stage, and they went, there's two classes of settlement here, rural or urban. Village is something in between. It's my feeling that as North Americans, there's a certain sentimentality that's involved in this word village. We all have ancestors who lived in real villages, and in those villages there was a sense of belonging, a sense of social cohesion that we just have long lost. And so this word eco-village, it's something we can all gather around. Yes, that's what we want. But if you look on the internet, the Global Eco-Village Network, for example, they're the clearinghouse, or they've taken on the responsibility. And I have so much respect for Ross and Hildur Jackson and everybody that's been working so hard for the last 10 years or so to get that set up. If you look at the Global Ecovillage Network, there's all different kinds of models of sustainable community listed. For example, there's a traveling caravan in South America that's listed as an ecovillage, described as an ecovillage. There's an urban block in Los Angeles that's an ecovillage. There's some people bought a warehouse in England and converted it into some of the techniques of putting glass on the south and growing food, and they called that their ecovillage. So from a sustainable settlement geography perspective, there might be many different variations of sustainable community. But what about the ecovillage where I live? We have many villages. There's they come in two varieties. One's two main varieties. One is a shopping center, as in Seaholme Village or Barkley Village, and another is an apartment complex, Viking Village. There's this use of the word village. So as I started out in my study of eco-villages and eco-village design, I feel very fortunate. I started out in 1994. I took a permaculture design course in 93, and I'd just like to say at the outset that eco-village design is just an advanced form of permaculture design. Permaculture is the foundation. When I started out in 94, there really was no precedent. There was the last chapter of the Permaculture Designer's Manual is devoted to village development, and it interfaces somewhat with in-context vision of eco-village, but there really was no precedent. And I was so fortunate that in 95, the world's first conference on sustainable eco-villages and sustainable communities was held at Findhorn. Findhorn being one of the premier models of eco-village in process. I'd like to say another bold statement right now. According to this definition, there doesn't exist a fully functioning eco-village anywhere. It's still all very much in process. Aspirations on various different levels is Brandy, and even Earth Haven eco-village. It's an organically growing eco-village, but it's, I would say, not fully functioning, nor is it able at this point to be continued into the indefinite future in its current form. But that's all academic. The point is that there's a real urge, a real need to have these sustainable communities. So anyway, in 95 at Findhorn was the world's first Ecovillages and Sustainable Communities Conference, and out of that grew the Global Ecovillage Network. And they right away, their mission was to act as a networking source to assist the spread of the eco-village model, the eco-village idea. And shortly after that, I made it to Findhorn. I was a student at Fairhaven College, and the flexibility there, that's where I first met Chris Pendleton, as a matter of fact. But the flexibility there allowed me to travel a little bit. So I made it to Findhorn, then I made it to Crystal Waters. Eventually, I made it to the farm. And I got to see the Global Ecovillage Network, their first couple village design courses, as they were attempting to take this new ecovillage model, idea, vision, and organize a coherent educational presentation around it. And so that was really, really, really valuable, invaluable in fact that I was developing my degree, I was getting a chance to experience the gestation of this new educational model. So I would go back to the university and then try to fill in the blanks with classes and independent studies. And what I developed was called a concentration called Village Design, Ecistics for the 21st Century. So there it was for me. The academic presentation comes down to this word ecistics. It's an expression of permaculture design, advanced permaculture design, but from an academic point of view, ecistics is the scientific multidisciplinary study of human settlements. So that pretty much says it all. It's that can make it very theoretical. It can include multidisciplinary. What if Bill Mollison says that in order to be sustainable. Human systems need to be modeled after natural systems. Well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. But the cities that we're building are essentially machines, mechanical systems. They're completely disconnected from the ecology that supports them. So we're attempting to make living systems. So if in order to be sustainable, if human systems need to be modeled after natural systems, then well, we better study biology. You know, biology as a prerequisite for eco-village design? Or how about anthropology? How about geology? You can just go on and on. But I'm trying to paint a picture here of eco-village design as being this broad, multidisciplinary subject or field that is growing even as we're sitting here. So, and eventually, currently, the educational model that had been developing for a while is beginning to fruit in several different initiatives around the world. The farm in Tennessee, let me say that the world's three premier eco-village models are Findhorn in Scotland, Crystal Waters in Australia, and the farm in Tennessee. Oroville in India is a different kind of settlement. So, but the three best examples are those three. They all have their own qualities. It really hasn't been all brought together in one place. That's why I say it's very much in process. Findhorn has a lively social life that often gets aired on the BBC. But from an ecological design point of view, there's nothing there that's worth emulating. I mean, people live in caravans or trailers that just leak heat. That's just the way it developed, you know. And then contrarily, Crystal Waters, from an ecological design or permaculture design point of view, is great care was taken into that part of it, but they didn't put any attention into the social design, so there tends to be some strife there. The farm, its strength is its economic structures. I was told 85% of the wage earners at the farm earn their living from businesses right within the farm, which is just extraordinary. The farm being 3 square miles, that means all three of these models have gotten up to about 300 people, by the way. For some reason, it's kind of tended to level off at 300. I think that's probably approaching village scale, but it's not. There's still a whole lot more room to go. And so, anyway, at the farm, Albert Bates and the folks there, they set up the world's first eco-village training center, which hosts courses of various kinds throughout the year, including eco-village design courses. There's the Global Eco-Village Network a few years ago now sponsored the creation of Living Roots, which is it's based out of the Sirius Eco-Village in Massachusetts, the Sirius community. And they have travel abroad programs that go through the Plum Village in India, and then they end up in Oroville, they go to Findhorn. And that's just an awesome way to experience. You have to be there really to understand it. This is not a field that can be learned through books and lectures. But to be there, there's no substitute for that. To be in these places, to feel what they're like, to walk the streets and the passageways. And I think I'll mention one more. Crystal Waters College. Yeah, at Crystal Waters, there's another initiative that's just forming. But anyway, if you're going to approach this from an academic point of view, remember that it's broadly multidisciplinary, and do your best to get out to where it's really happening. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ben Kaufman. Let's see here. I want to talk a little bit about, I have a business my father and I run. It's a real estate business up in Seattle. And what we focus in on is green homes, environmentally friendly homes, and then also community-focused housing projects and developments. But let me explain a little bit how I got to that spot. I was back when I was about 20 years old. I was traveling. I came from a background that was very, very white bread. I grew up in typical suburbia, edge cities, as they're called, Tyson's Corner. I actually grew up in Fairfax, which is just next to the case study for edge cities, which is Tyson's Corner. It's a bedroom community that grew up and became its own over in, outside of Washington, D.C., but also in Bellevue. And so I came from a very homogenous existence and really didn't know anything about, I had no clue about intentional communities, communes. I had no understanding of the depth that life could offer. And when I was traveling, I was over on the North Shore of Kauai, and there were some folks there that I ran into that were involved in the original caravan that Stephen Gaskin had led from San Francisco across the country to Tennessee to found the farm. And so these were original members of the farm, and they were over now living on the North Shore of Kauai, which was a real strong introduction at a very formative stage in life to organic farming, to community, to a lifestyle which was rich in love, care for one another, respect for the earth, and these things really made a huge impression on me. But coming from that traditional background, I was really puzzled over how I could take all of what life had brought to me and kind of integrate that into a business, a lifestyle that I could really work in every day and feel positive about. So that kind of, for the last 10 years now or more, I've been working towards, in real estate basically, you know, always with an eye towards sustainable community development. Basically bridging together the two worlds is what I'm interested in doing. And so I worked, I did Co-Opportunities Northwest, which was I was one of the co-founders of that up in Seattle. It was 2 years ago. We had about 600 people. It's over 3 days. It was free. It was very similar to Synergy. We had 9 panels. We had exhibits, workshops, a speaker series. All on sustainable community development, kind of looking at all of the popcorning that was happening with in innovation, in everything having to do with in the environmental movement, and really kind of making that more place-based and proximate. And so what I'm doing with GreenWorks is looking at environmentally friendly homes and then also the community-focused residential projects. Really, I guess what I wanted to talk about was two things, kind of the range of projects that I consider, you know, with using the lens of, I mean, I'm sure most of you have heard of natural capitalism, Paul Hawken, and what he wrote with three-legged stool in sustainability, where you've got the commerce, economy, you have the environment, and you have social and society, and those are the three-legged stool. That's a three-legged stool where, you know, take one leg out and forget about it. Those are the three kind of measures of sustainability, a triple bottom line, if you will. So using environment and community as the lens with which to look at real estate, what I do is I look at environmentally friendly homes and then the community-focused housing developments. Now, this assumes that the economics work. That's just kind of, it has to pencil out basically for property to move forward. So what I do is I take a look at the projects in the Puget Sound area that, from environmentally friendly, there's a gamut of projects. There's solar projects, Energy Star projects. Probably Energy Star is the beginning. If a typical real estate developer is going to go in and try and do something that's more green, he or she is going to look at an Energy Star program. And that's a way of putting in light fixtures, thermal windows, and there's a whole litany of checklist items that you can use and incorporate, low motors in dishwashers, washing machines that use less electricity. Then there's solar homes. Then there's several built green programs in the area. I'm most familiar with one that's located in King County. These are all kind of setting the stage for, in taking the knowledge and wisdom of eco-villages and intentional communities and all of the breadth and the depth that you have on one end of the gamut, all of the trials and tribulations, all of the kind of, there's some amazing innovations that are occurring in eco-villages and intentional communities. And I think that it's an amazing incubator that mainstream society is completely ignoring, just completely ignoring. There's just no clue. When you talk to real estate agents, most builders, some architects, some of them start paying attention, some designers. But banks forget about it. Appraisers absolutely forget about it. There's just very little understanding. I mean, you're just starting to see some understanding of co-housing in the lending and appraisal worlds. So this idea of an eco-village where you've got fully featured human settlement on a large piece of land, what I'm always looking at is kind of there's two ways to go about doing an eco-village. I think that you could call an eco-village something where you're gaining control of the land through ways that do not require money, through squatting, through a friendly landowner who invites you onto the land. Then there's another way, which is to pay for the land through traditional means, a seller carry, a bank finance loan, or cash out. And so land prices on that end of the spectrum, when you're dealing about an eco-village that is formed, when you're paying for it, the land price really starts the process of, okay, how do we pay for the mortgage that covers the purchase of the land? And so I spend a lot of time looking at ways to take that knowledge and work backwards from it, to bring it to the mainstream so that you've got design elements that you'll see in co-housing where you have periphery parking, you've got a common house, and then you have homes, individual units, clustered around a square with pedestrian scale. And you have a tremendous amount. In co-housing, the model is that the people come before the buildings do, and they work together to create the project. There's also, I've noticed, there's courtyard cottages where you have smaller homes clustered around a village square or courtyard, a green space. And these two will have very similar design elements of co-housing where you've got the periphery parking, the common house, and then the cluster around a village square. But it's done on spec. It's speculation on whether or not these projects are going to sell. There's no buyers for it ahead of time. So the developer goes out, finances the land, finances the building, and then has to recoup his or her money from the selling of the of the units themselves. So getting back to the environmentally friendly elements of kind of the range of projects where you can kind of take the knowledge of eco-villages and intentional communities and distill them backwards on this range of environmentally friendly and community. You've got also the natural building, straw bales. You have cob, rammed earth, rostra, use of recycled materials on the building envelope and interiors, the finishes, low toxic use of finishes, glues, low VOC paints. And so that's kind of the environmentally friendly element. And then there's the community element. The community element, again, kind of starting with the cottage housing around a village green, going to co-housing, then going to full-fledged eco-villages, of which, as has been mentioned, there's eco-villages that are underway, but there is not an eco-village that meets the full definition. We're not there yet. And there's a lot of people, a lot of very dedicated, passionate people working extremely hard to bring this about. And I Diana's book is fantastic in that it really does paint the picture that 90% don't work out and 10% do. And of the 10% that do, they pay a lot of attention. I was really impressed with the fact that it's about nuts and bolts. It's about the zoning. It's about the density. It's about bringing in your utilities and your access. It's not something. I mean, it's about having a mission statement, a vision statement, and so these are all very. It's a traditional developer doesn't go through any of these hoops. I mean, if you're a traditional real estate developer and you're making 15% on a real estate project, a traditional suburban cookie cutter, ticky tack box project, which I think it's a sad fact that that's what is out there. There's just very little innovation there. It's really a nuts and bolts. You really have to have your act together and have a lot of broad-based knowledge and skills and have some chutzpah, have some vision to go out there and make these real and make them work. So what I wanted to talk about also, I'll spend just a little bit of time on, is some eco-village projects that I know of that come close to meeting, or at least that are planned, that people have been talking about in the Pacific Northwest. And there's beyond Lost Valley Educational Center in Oregon, which is up and running and functioning as an education center. And it's one of the examples in Diana's book. Beyond that, what's kind of on the slate, what's being planned, what people are interested in forming, there's a project called... it's Fairview. It's called Fairview down in Salem, Oregon, and it's a 275-acre site located within a couple of miles. I think 2 miles from downtown Salem. Salem has a population of about 100,000 people. It was a state mental health hospital. It was formed in 1908. Was the first building on the site. It was continued. There are now 78 buildings on the site for a total of about 700 square feet of space. And it was a self-sustaining community. It had its own garden. It has a commissary that can produce thousands of meals a day, a full-scale commercial kitchen. I mean, it has a pool with a workout room. It has its own elementary school. Has its own church. It's an amazing site, and a very visionary person got a hold of it. Basically, convinced Kitzhaber, the former mayor, to let them purchase the property, have rights to develop. And this project, unfortunately, at the moment, it's right in the middle of its kind of formative stages, where they have money, a couple million dollars on the line right now, and through a lot of investors, and this kind of one visionary person has come spearhead and put out this vision for pushing the envelope. Christopher Alexander's involved in it. You've got some of the top planners involved in the industry that are out there looking at this project. Paul Hawkins has been on the site. Amory Levins has been on the site. But there's been some problems with control at the top. There's a the actual associate organization body, the few people that are kind of running the organization, are kind of, they're worried. They're worried that they have all this money on the line and that they're not going to be able to sell these things. And that they're going to, it's not their own money, it's all their investors' money. And they're just worried, though, and they're starting to water down the project. And so there's this kind of, the person who has the vision wasn't necessarily, he went in there working under consensus, and then he ended up meeting people and drawing people in that were more interested in the bottom line. And so there's this, the nice guy is maybe, is losing some control. And when you lose control of a project, you water down the vision a lot of times, because this board, their consensus is to take a safer route. So that's something that's underway right now. It's evolving. There's a site over on Bainbridge Island that was, it was under control this past this fall. There was a couple of acres near Winslow, the ferry landing there between Seattle and Bainbridge Island. And that, that so far, that right now, that's kind of not happening. The contract is now passed where the developer had control of it, who was proposing the Eco Village. So, and that had to do with finding financing. It was a large multi-million-dollar, it was over $10 million project. And so where do you get the money for that? And there was not enough investors that were willing to come up with that kind of money to support the project. And so the project did not move forward. And then there's another project that's, there's potential for a village to be developed somewhere in western Washington. It's in conjunction with a festival that's being planned for western Washington. And right now it's kind of a land search for a site, and it's kind of broad scale right now. The festival itself is looking to talk about sustainable examples of agriculture, forestry, looking at community and also energy, and it's really working strongly in the local community, there is the potential. I think that economy really drives eco-village development. You know, where people finding jobs is crucial. And that goes back to the land price, really. You know, the land price dictates so much of the amount of money that goes into the project. And so, and the scale to which development is drawn out. Where are people finding jobs to drive the rent or the mortgage payments? To pay for all of this, to pay for everyone's time. And so a festival is in conjunction with an education center in an area not so far from a developed area is it actually a fantastic way, I think, of going about developing a residential, fully featured settlement. And there is one that is kind of... The festival would need to come first, but then there's the possibility of doing some residential after that. And and I would say that Friday night there's Jim Hightower speaking, and so supporting that function is a way to support coming to that and bringing your friends and family is one way to support some of this work that's happening along those lines. And finally, I wanted to say... I'm always as trying to bring this together. That land is the driving factor. So each of you, through your personal connections, if you know of land that's available, that is by far the most valuable. That's the start gate, is the land. And particularly if you have someone that has the kind of views and philosophies that are represented today, and that would like to talk about how to come and together and create and. There's anywhere from 40 to 400 plus acres. If anyone here knows of anyone, or if there's any change of relationships, by all means, please say something to me.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, thank you.
So before we go on to questions. I do want to reiterate what Ben was saying. There's a Dancing Dragons event on Friday night featuring Jim Hightower. If you're here from Saul Williams a couple Fridays ago, Peace is returning to open up for Jim Hightower. She's an amazing hip-hop artist, spoken word poet, and educator from Seattle who's doing nonprofit education through hip-hop and poetry and self-empowerment. Then there's some music as well, so don't miss that event. You can buy tickets at the bookstore if you're a student, and if you're not a student, you can buy tickets at Rainy Day Records or online. So don't miss that event. Also, Saturday, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., the Finhorn Foundation is going to be speaking here. And if you have a program, the details of the room are in there. I'm sorry, I forgot to write down when I was taking notes what room it is. But the Finhorn, if you're interested in intentional communities, Finhorn Foundation and Finhorn Group has been doing work with intentional communities as an intentional community for a while. So, what, 30 years or something? 35 years? Yeah, they've been around for a while. So, good experience base from them. So, to start the Q&A, I'd like to ask the panel a question. This goes to all of you. Are the grassroots... and those of us who are in the grassroots, the Joe Schmoes and the Jane Does, well, the living Jane Does, we'll say, are the grassroots movements towards eco-villages gaining popularity? And if they are, why are they gaining why is eco-village gaining popularity with the grassroots movements? Sure, if you'd like to.
Okay. Well, I think that's true. I think more and more people in the 90s and in the beginning of this century are interested in what they would call community. I have this little theory that's not scientific. There's something called the community gene, I just made this up, which is this yearning for a sense of connection with neighbors and friends and more community energy than isolated, alienated, nuclear family suburban America would let us have, and Canada, and North America. And I have a feeling that a lot of people in the 90s and now have been having this, like, switching in their brain that says, community, I want it. What is it? I want it. And that people are yearning for it. And that a lot of people are getting the idea, oh, let's create some community in our neighborhood. Wow, did you see Mark Lakeman's presentation this morning? Oh, it was such a turn-on. And so I think there's a lot of community happening in Portland neighborhoods with activists like there are there. And I think that there are a lot of people saying, yum, intentional community, or yum, 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 eco-village, let's go start them. So I think there's way more interest right now. So I think the second part of your question is why. And I think it's because a culture can only be disconnected with its roots and its heart for so long before people start to go, wait a minute, something's wrong here. We're missing something desperately important to our very soul as a species, you know. And so, I mean, I think that suburbia getting invented in 1920 in Los Angeles and then getting popularized by the need for housing for returning GIs after World War II, and then the fact that cars and then television took over, and we built housing for cars, not us, has stretched out thin to the stratosphere of what we can tolerate. And we're finally going, wait a minute, we're taking back our lives. And that on an intuitive, visceral, heart, body, soul level, people are going, no, 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 I'm not standing for this anymore. Even though they might not have ever known what it was like to live in grandma or great-grandma's day when we had an extended family around the hearth. But I think that on some cellular level, we know that we need that. Don't you think? That's why you're here, huh? So that's my answer to that one.
That's kind of interesting. I started to question, what does grassroots mean, as I was thinking about how you frame that. So let's look at that. What does grassroots mean? Because perhaps we have a stereotype about that word. And maybe if we think about it, it's really anything and anybody that's rooted in the space that we're defining. So is it community-based? And does grassroots mean a particular group of people? Or are we really talking about the people in the community? So that could be young or old or activist or politician. But maybe if it's any of us that want to work from the bottom places upwards and call it a whole system, and any of that, I think working at a local level is grassroots. So is this happening more and more at a grassroots level? I would say that every one of us probably just echoed that, and probably everyone in this room hears the word community more in the last couple years than you've ever heard it in your life. So I hear conversations constantly where people talk about kind of a groundswell of people that are coming. And when we start turning around and having the banks coming to us and political figureheads coming to us, and they're talking about community development on a whole nother level, when they're actually talking about eco-hamlets and they've heard that term before, then maybe there is something happening out there. And I think it's reflected all over the place, not just looking at sort of we define the political and the academic and the community-based and the legal aspects of how we were talking about eco-villages today, but in terms of developing eco-villages, one of the big focuses we've had in Canada suddenly this last year is finance, ownership, and governance. So there's pretty much everybody who's going to have to look at how to approach sustainable, cooperative, live, work kind of ways to share from a financial level, also from an ownership level. Are we talking about co-ops? Are we talking about land shares? Are we talking about what kind of model? And then how are we going to govern that? How does our social interactions work in a way that's way different? So really, what about if we reframed our idea of grassroots and went back to the idea that community is by, for, and through community, and that is happening more and more wherever we turn around, hopefully.
We have a question from the audience. Would you like to field that?
Sure. I saw two hands go up at once. And your hand's still up, so you're the winner.
First of all, the gal from Canada, could you tell me what you've built so far, or have you built anything? Yeah, what you built and who's living on the property and that sort of thing. That's one question.
Okay, so how much has been built? In the example that I've been talking about here, there was existing buildings on the property. So structurally, we could have probably about 12 people at any given time living indoors. Summertime, we have up to 25, 30 people that can be living on site. And as we go, now we talked about laying the foundation. And there is a theoretic context to that, but there's also a really practical material context to that, where you have to do the zoning, and you have to work through the regs, and you have to do the policy, and you have to do the decision-making before you can build the house. Because when you have a piece of property and you're only allowed one house on it, you got a process to go through first. So now, with the new regs, we have the ability to build 9 more residences. Last year, a Canadian Natural Builders School took on a first climate change demonstration building for Canada. So that's a cob and straw bale building. And we've started on yurts, So we've built building after building, but now the residences come.
Okay. Is this work? Okay, I'm sorry. I lived in a co-housing for 1 year out here in this area, and I also have an urban planning degree, so I'm really kind of interested. Now, I've visited a lot of co-housing complexes, and what I've noticed, they work. They seem to work, except where they fail and where they kind of lose their impetus and thrust is because people don't work on the land, so to speak. It seems like there isn't a cohesion, and it starts to, you know, the fabric starts to turn into a subdivision after a while. And this eco-village idea appealed to me because it sounded like you actually start to do create businesses on the land that actually work with the land. Now, you're saying that there's very few of those, or there's hardly any of those within this country, or I couldn't quite grasp that. Is the farm one of them? Is the place beyond Lost Valley or whatever? I mean, what is available when you get past the co-housing model, which is the residential ecological aspect where you take care of the land and you have a little common house and all that sort of thing and integrated social structures? Because, like I said, that fabric loses itself and becomes a subdivision after a while.
I wonder if I could, thank you, suggest something. I'd really love to hear what Chris and Ben might have answered to that question. And I'm wondering if that question, which I think several of us would be eager to answer, we could wait on it until they've spoken their answer to the original question. May we do that? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. I mean, that comes to the core of what we're trying to get to here. And I want to get back to Chris's original question about the grassroots. And every evidence that I see says, yes, this is definitely growing in interest, but not only in interest, but in necessity. Has anybody ever seen the bell curve for petroleum use in the industrialized world? It's a rapid spike. And I've recently read a book called The Hydrogen Economy, where there's a prediction within 10 or 15 years, maybe as early as 7 or 8, that petroleum use, the availability of petroleum, is going to max out, and then we're going to be in the backslide of that curve. And that's going to be a kind of disassembling of what civilization has put together. In one sense, it's going to be predictions out of necessity, a kind of a dismantling of the global economy, a kind of a dispersal of settlements. It's because of the availability of cheap oil that urban populations have become so dense. So we're going to see this model not only, it's not going to be like it is in Australia right now. It's very much mainstream. It's Ecovillage is very much moving mainstream. The United States is far behind the rest of the world in this kind of thinking, but all because of necessity. So I think definitely as this 21st century, this is going to be the Ecovillage century, and not just out of like a biological need for community, but an economic need for a dispersal of settlements and an economic base on the land, things like that, place-based economics and so forth.
Yeah, I'd have to say in answer to the grassroots question, there's definitely a lot of support and a lot of energy and a lot of questions asked, and Living Roots is, when I first started looking at it maybe 7-8 years ago, Living Roots didn't exist. I found my way to Crystal Waters just through doing some searches on the internet, and I found out about Jen. It totally blew me away. Just really amazing time. I think that ultimately eco-villages or sustainable community lifestyles are where we need to be, because I think it's the only way I can see. I think it's the greatest solution to mankind's pressing issues, severe pressing issues that we all live under at the moment. It's the best solution I've ever found, and that's why I'm in the industry. That's why I spend all my time on it, or why I'm passionate about it, because I think it's the answer. But so maybe talk a little bit about the question about, I guess, what's happening in eco-villages around here. I'm also on the board of NICA, Northwest Intentional Communities Association, and we're kind of a loose organization of people that live in community that talk amongst one another to kind of share how to raise kids, how to pay for grocery bills, how to run yourself once you're in a co-housing or rural intentional community project. And there's a database available of all the communities. It's tied in also with FIC, which maintains the communities directory. And so there's a lot of resources out there that kind of points to intentional communities. And I think intentional communities are about as close as you're going to get to an eco-village. You'll see most of the eco-villages that could be called an eco-village listed in the communities directory. And also that involved in the network of NICA. Mostly what I'm seeing is residential-based. I'm not seeing the fully-featured human settlement, or the fully-featured part, which speaks to having in real estate speak, having an industrial, retail, commercial, and residential use on the land. And you usually will see residential with maybe one or two cottage, either retail or commercial uses. So, but to see all of them is exceedingly rare. And the Fairhaven or Fairview, the project down in Salem, was by far what I thought had the greatest legs. But it was such a big undertaking, and it involved so much risk to people that were mainstream folks. That, and it involved, you know, the purchase of the land itself was $12 million. It was, you know, several hundred households. It was just a very big project, and people started getting nervous. And so it's starting to lose some steam. If anyone, it could be rescued, but it's going to take a couple million dollars, someone loaning it to the organization to keep it strong, keep the focus going, who has those values. But other than that, the Bainbridge one fell through. I think this, what's happening with a festival site, that's down the road a little bit, but that has potentially, if there's issues such as zoning worked out, that has a lot of promise. A heck of a lot of promise, I think. Other than that, there's not much, not a whole lot.
May I answer that question as well? I actually see it a little bit differently. And first of all, I see that there are aspiring eco-villages. I would agree with the other folks on this panel that there aren't any full-featured human-scale settlements going on through seven generations, because we haven't had but 10 or 15 years of that concept yet, as articulated with these words in these days. But I see Earth Haven Ecovillage, where I live, which is going on 10 years old, with plenty of infrastructure and development. Y'all come and visit us now sometime. And Dancing Rabbit, an aspiring ecovillage in northeastern Missouri, about 7 or 8 years old, with about 20 people, regular tours of the site, lots of straw bale buildings, off-grid power, organic vegetables. I'm going to be speaking on Saturday night. I hope that you'll be coming. I'm going to describe Earth Haven in greater detail. 60 people, two or three multi-story buildings that are passive solar design, timber framed, and also clay straw and straw bale with earth plaster and roof water catchment and, you know, the whole nine yards. I mean, we're doing it, you know. Dancing Rabbit's doing it. Sirius Community in western Massachusetts has aspects of eco-village in their intentions and in their design and in their aspirations for themselves. Lost Valley Educational Center in Dexter, Oregon. It's not very far away. They teach permaculture. They teach Naka'ima, which is a self-healing, good communication process system. They teach organic gardening. They teach permaculture. They teach natural buildings. This summer, they're having a 2-month sustainable living course. I'm going to come back out and teach there at it. And so are lots of other local folks like Toby Hemingway and so on. Los Angeles Ecovillage is a shining example of a grassroots, here, let's do it where we're living here in the heart of downtown Los Angeles. Ecovillage at Ithaca is a marvelous example of a group of people who have 176 acres, 2.5 miles from downtown Ithaca, New York. They have 2 of 3 planned co-housing communities clustered together. They have their own CSA farm. They have all kinds of marvelous plans for further community infrastructure, and they've got 2 neighborhoods up and running. So, Ithaca, New York. Is it in my book? No. But one of the co-founders is writing her own book about Ecovillage at Ithaca. My book profiles Lost Valley, Earth Haven Ecovillage, Dancing Rabbit Ecovillage, Meadow Dance in Vermont, Mariposa Grove, an urban community in Oakland, and Sewing Circle Occidental Arts and Ecology Center in Occidental, California, and also Abundant Dawn Community, a rural community in southwestern Virginia. I used different parts of what they did to illustrate what I think is important to know about standing on the shoulders of giants.
And let me just add a comment to that. I meant the Pacific Northwest. Particularly Washington State, but the Pacific Northwest is where I haven't, there's Lost Valley is the shining star of the Pacific Northwest, and in Brighton Bush as well, but to some degree, but yeah.
So we have 10 minutes left for questions and answers, and I'd like to offer the questions up and maybe offer one or two for the answers, and then so that we can fit in a maximum amount of questions in the next 10 minutes.
All right. I have a social kind of question. I come from an extremely small town on an island, and I've been hearing massive amounts about community, 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 community. And being from a community, I never hear the side addressed that communities can be incredibly claustrophobic, very, very judgmental, very xenophobic, very, you're just trapped sometimes. And I wanted to know sort of what some of the communities you've been talking about have done about that, or if they've addressed it at all, or if that's part of the problems that they have.
I'd like to answer that one because my background is as a therapist, and that's why I came to community in the first place and in the way I have now. And I describe kind of going around the circuitous route and working in bureaucracies and so forth and looking at ways to support change, and then came around full circle and realized that community is the therapeutic tool that is a necessity to have as the foundation for people actually healing. And so absolutely, I think most communities would answer that conflict and challenge is an inherent part of community building, but it's also an inherent part of every relationship on the planet. And I'm not just talking about people relationships. So if the toxicity is there, how do we reinstate some tools to learn to live in a village structure again? Do you want to ask another part in there?
Like really, really specifically, the problems I'm talking about are the problems that come from being in a situation where it's so small, and there can be very few options available to explore. I know also that communities are wonderful. I know about all the good side of communities, but we already talked about that. So I'm not so much talking about conflict as I'm talking about
isolation,
enclosure, and isolation. Yeah.
Could I address that? Oh, go ahead.
Isolation is actually a breakdown of community. It's not a community building. Okay. So places where you see vast amounts of sexual abuse, alcoholism, and other forms of substance abuse, and that kind of toxicity is usually because we've separated ourselves and communities have become isolated. Communities will form our own norms no matter where we put ourselves. A group will create a group dynamic. So the way I was going to answer that back to you is about reinventing or creating tools in order to live in the context of how we want to be in community. So, and there's brilliant community process folks out there, and it's not just around decision making and conflict resolution, but there's an inherent process that every kind of group goes along, and you know, we might call it forming, storming, norming, and conforming, or there's lots of lingo out there for the process. Some people fashion that or parallel it to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's idea of how we go through the stages of death and dying, and how we come to those places of acceptance and surrender about being with ourselves and being with each other. Denial is a long stage in there. But really, we maybe as a society, in many places in the world, we have separated ourselves from community for so long, and that social construct of how to be together, because it used to be an inherent natural state. And now, as we've come back through our phase of rugged individualism, now we're starting to come back around to community, but it doesn't mean we know how to be together. It doesn't mean that we understand how to not gossip and backstab or cutthroat or just change that there's been competition in our lives for, you know, all these decades. And those are the places and the ways that now we're starting to invent folks and tools to walk ourselves through that. And it's kind of all hands on deck to figure out how to get to that.
I'd also like to add that I don't know of any intentional communities that have interests in sustainability that isolate themselves the way an unintentional community or a circumstantial community might end up being, like a small hamlet on an island. I think that you're referring to something that doesn't usually occur in intentional communities and eco-villages, because they're quite often really interested in interacting with the mainstream culture around them in beneficial ways, you know.
Hi. I've really appreciated the things you've had to say today. I work as a sustainability coordinator for our state parks, which are 250 villages that are in bad shape. But so I'm here this week to kind of get a less institutional view. I'm a greener. And in the 60s, I lived in a commune in the 60s, in the 70s, and then one here in Washington on Harriet Bullitt's property. It was an interesting experience, and I've brought a lot of those to my work with state government. And now my question for you: we're very interested in seeing energy used more efficiently in this state. Are renewable energies being put? I haven't heard one of you mention a windmill, a hydro, or a solar panel. That's what sustainable energy building is using. That's what the cutting edge is, and I would hope that intentional communities are doing it. Now, I do recall that in the 70s, the farm was experimenting with some solar, some of the really early solar. Could someone speak to that, renewable energies?
I can, but maybe you want to, Chris.
I think, intentional communities and eco-villages in particular are definitely educational models. I mean, the one that Brandy's working on now, just because she's gotten this far, it's become an educational model. And everybody's consciously, working to include the technologies that you're talking about. Finhorn, for example, has a giant windmill that they've named Moira that sells, sells electricity back to the grid. It makes so much. Yeah, definitely. That's definitely part of the vision. And wherever possible, it's being implemented. Passive solar design and hybrid technologies. I'm really curious about the fuel cells, the hydrogen fuel cells that tend to decentralize energy power. So yeah, that's definitely part of the vision. And you can go through, you can check the internet, check the websites for each of these, the Global Ecovillage Network, and there's a whole section on that. And then you can go by each village, each intentional community, each ecovillage, and then see what they're using specifically.
Sirius Eco Village has some buildings that are off the grid. Dancing Rabbit has some off the grid buildings, and Earth Haven Eco Village, where I live, is entirely off the grid.
Wow, great!
Mm-hmm. In the states that allow it.
Up on in River Farm, up in Deming, Washington, outside of Bellingham, they're. They're on the grid, but what they're doing is they have a mobile solar panel education program, and they go around to a lot of the festivals during the summer and talk about solar and how they can, what the uses are, the technology is of solar. Yeah, yeah. So there's definitely innovation that comes out of it.
You know, I would really recommend, not just to yourself but to everybody here, that it's really easy for us to give you examples. But grassroots work is also about you going out and finding your examples. And the start place, very simply, there's 600 communities listed in the Federation for Intentional Communities Directory, and that was in the year 2000. And there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them since then. And there's so many groups that never even list themselves, but they're everywhere. And once you start waking up, you know, are conscious to just turning around and having the conversation with people, you'll find out that there's stuff in your backyard that you never even knew about. And then it's really about us just collecting our energy and working together.
Yeah, I think an excellent example of what you're talking about, something that could have some is take windmills and find some land over in eastern Washington where windmills work. And that's usually maybe Cle Elum, and there's usually it's usually vacant land out there. Large swaths of open space, and the money made from the windmills would be a great economic generator of an intentional community. Great model. Yeah.
That's actually the last question. Sorry, Katrina, we're running close to time. And before I end, I wanted to offer something to the state, too, which is something that hasn't been mentioned yet, but is unfortunately against code, and that's catching water and conserving resources that we have on site and that come organically from our environment. So working with state at the state level and the national level to make things like that, to have incentives from the government to do things like that would be amazing, to be able to actually drink the water, use it in our toilets, have worm box toilets instead of having flush toilets take fresh water and pollute them directly. What's that?
Susha, we're there. We're totally solar. We've got composting and everything, but then there's no power going in there. So.
Okay, so thank you very much for panelists. Diana Leave Christian, Brandy McPherson, E. Christopher Mayer, and Ben Kaufman. Thank you very much.